Growing up, I had a lot to be thankful for. A safe and beautiful home, loving parents, and mostly loving siblings. Then came high school. By then, my small stature, eccentric personality, and struggles with my sexuality made relationships of any kind difficult. It so happens that my parents' marriage was also under great stress around then, so it didn't seem like a good time to ask for their help. By age 18, I was bewildered, angry, lonely, and scared, knowing that it was time for me to grow up, get a job, and then undertake the overwhelming task of pursuing college. How is it going to get this ball rolling in the next few months, I wondered. Will anyone help me? Do I have the intellect necessary to fulfill my dreams? Will anyone ever want me as a spouse? As you can see, I didn't think my worth was on par with my peers. And dignity? What was that? Several months after high school graduation, while I was still trying to figure everything out, I had an opportunity to become a helper for a few weeks to my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Chazar. Bonnie Chazar had been a family friend since my sister was in her class 6 years before I was. Our teacher was stylish, distinctive, confident, and a little mysterious. Her words were thoughtful, concise, and always calm. On many of the winter afternoons that I helped Mrs. C after her students went home and for the day and after I finished cranking out mimeographs for her for the next morning, she and I would spend time together in her classroom. Somehow, she made it known that it was okay for me to unload what was eating me. I knew her well enough to trust her confidence and wisdom. So out it came: school, home, college, employment, ... Unlike when I was her student, though, this time I enjoyed her full attention. All she did was listen. She simply listened. She didn't interrupt, she didn't judge, and she didn't offer advice until she was certain I said what I needed to. When she did speak, she no longer did so as to a child, but to me, a young adult. To be honest, I don't remember most of what she said, though at least one response went like this: "Everyone has challenges, but your family loves you, and they're doing their best." She affirmed what part of me already knew. After maybe a dozen of these afternoons, my work with her was completed, and she had some parting words for me. I don't remember exactly what the words were, but in essence, she said, "Jim, the seed for your future is already inside you. It's not going to happen all at once. So give that seed a little care and help it grow." In other words, we all have worth. We all deserve dignity. But too often we forget that among the distractions of our lives, many of us need to invest the time in rediscovering our dignity. Sure enough, it didn't happen all at once. But those afternoons with my teacher, along with some other pivotal experiences in my life, eventually helped me see that all of us have a seed inside, planted in our histories, filled with our dreams, and holding our potential for greatness. It changed the way I saw myself, my family, my coworkers, classmates, friends, competitors, and those I love. Sometimes I still think of those winter afternoons with Mrs. Chazar and see what an extraordinary gift they were.
That moment in the service when the minister realizes she forgot to tell the ushers that she's adding a reading. Ushers, I'm adding a reading. I was going to include this reading, refer to it in my sermon and quote a couple of lines, but I love it so much I decided to bring it all to you this morning. It's by Meg Barnhouse. She's minister at in Austin, Texas. Titled, "Who Says Unitarian Universalist Principles Are Easy?" I have gone to a lot of church services in my time. When I was 8, wearing Mary Jane shoes and white stockings in a blue coat with a velveteen collar my mother had made, sitting next to my little sister in her coat, identical to mine, trying not to wiggle in the pew, I would make check marks as the sections of the order of service finished. Hymn number 1, pastoral prayer, scripture reading, sermon. I loved checking off the sermon. My cousin Ed the Brave would carry a transistor radio in his pocket and run the earphone up through his shirt so you could barely see the wire carrying music or a ball game into his ear. The church of my childhood had big plain windows, eggshell walls, red carpet. I think the most exciting thing that ever happened in church was when the man in front of me was so still that a small spider was able to spin a web in the angle of his neck, stretching the silk from ear to shoulder of his gray suit, making a perfect design that was only disturbed when he rose to sing the last hymn. We colored our bulletins and we looked through the hymnals, making ourselves giggle by adding "between the sheets" to their titles. A Baptist friend said they added "in the bathtub." "Turn back, O man, between the sheets. We three kings of Orient are in the bathtub." Years ago, I came to Unitarian Universalist Community of Faith. I'm home. I listen to people talk sometimes about liberal religion as if it were a thin gruel watered down to please everyone. Our 7 principles, they complain, are either too much like a creed or so general as to be meaningless. My experience of the principles is that they are deeply demanding. The first one asked me to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, which means that I can no longer subscribe to the Calvinist doctrine of total depravity of human nature. It sounds grim, but really, if you are in fact starting with a totally depraved nature, the opportunities for self-congratulation abound. Hey, I didn't knock over a 7-Eleven this afternoon, even though money's tight. Yay for me. Now, I have to struggle with the worth and dignity of people who do unspeakably awful things, whereas the doctrine of total depravity made that a no-brainer. I'm supposed to value the democratic process, hearing the voices of everyone equally, allowing everyone to have a say. The UU principles are demanding enough to make me whine. For those who feel they are a thin gruel, I have a suggestion. Let's stick something on the end of every principle that will stop people from smiling and nodding comfortably as they are read. Instead of adding "in the bathtub" or "between the sheets," how about attaching "beginning in our homes and our congregations"? Then we'd be faced with affirming things like the goal of peace, liberty, and justice for all, beginning in our homes and in our congregations. Everyone who has raised children know that peace is often at odds with liberty, and that justice demands a disturbance of the peace. To put those three together in one principle is outrageous and lovely. It's easier to think about working towards them in a global context than in the context of Cheerios and pajamas, car keys, and cleaning one's bedroom. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, beginning in our homes and our congregations, is a sobering ideal. I don't know about you, but I have sat in meetings about right relations and seen people get testy with one another. Some of the nastiest behavior I've seen was long ago at a community workshop for peace activists. For me, the heart of the liberal faith is to be connected to something greater than yourself, to wallow in the spirit of life, love, and truth, to have fair trade coffee and important conversations, to stand for love, and to stand against quibbling, complaining, and flouncing off in a huff, to move towards being in right relationship with ourselves, one another, and the planet. For me, this faith isn't a thin gruel. It's not even a rich and hearty gruel. It's walnuts and bananas, pancakes, mangoes, arugula, ginger, and avocado. The feast is prepared with effort, enjoyment, persistence, and commitment. Care to join me? Next Sunday is our Exploring Unitarian Universalism class. This is something we offer every third Sunday, and it's a chance to learn more about Unitarian Universalism, especially for newcomers, but everyone is welcome. And I'm going to be focusing on the principles and sources at the class next Sunday. And I always offer that Meg Barnhouse reading as a handout for people to reinforce the importance of our principles and the challenge that they present. I love her point that the principles are easy to agree with, but harder to live into. So today, in my time with you, I'm going to focus on our first principle: affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. But in the spirit of Meg Barnhouse, I'm going to suggest that we add to the end of that our own and that of others. Affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, our own and that of others. Now, before I delve more deeply into that principle, I want to give you a little bit, some ideas about the historical context. Meg Barnhouse talked about Calvinism and the idea of the total depravity of humans, which was the prevailing Protestant theology in our country in the early 19th century. And it was the response to Calvinism that created the energies of both Unitarian and Universalism. Unitarianism, the idea, not only are we not inherently depraved, but we have an essence of the divine in us, a likeness to God inside of each individual. Universalists called out the idea that God was too loving a God for anyone to be sent to hell. Too loving a God, and so God's love was part of who we were. So therefore, nobody was automatically depraved or automatically sent to hell. So this was the ideas that Unitarians and Universalists brought that infuse now in our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, as opposed to the idea of the basic depravity of humans. These are seem like old-fashioned ideas to us, but it's not too hard to find a church in our community that continues to present the idea that humans are born in sin. Now, when I bring up the origins of this or the whole idea of inherent worth and dignity, there's always somebody goes, well, what about Hitler? Does Hitler have inherent worth and dignity? That's a challenging aspect. And I would say Hitler had inherent worth and dignity as a human being living on this earth. But his life, his choices, the things that happened to him, and the things that he chose to do created a source and a presence of evil in our world. Now, the Universalists got all tied up in this problem when they were developing their theology in the 19th century, because people really had trouble with the idea that everyone was going to heaven. So the Universalists would debate endlessly these theologies of, all right, so maybe the really bad people went somewhere else first and had counseling, and then they went to heaven. But there were ultra-universalists who said, no, if God loves and saves everyone, then that means everyone. And it continues to be a challenging issue, and I think is part of why UUs don't have a very well-developed theology of evil. But evil is not our topic today. So let's go back to this principle. I want to look at every word and reflect on what the meaning of those words are. Inherent worth and dignity. The word inherent implies an essential aspect of something, something given about what they are. And so for humans, this means the inherent thing is an essential aspect of being human, part of our being human. Worth is a word that we're familiar with, something that has value. To say that something has worth means that that thing has value. So you put inherent and worth together, and you have the idea of humans have inherent value, that in theistic language, we are part of God's creation and are beautiful and lovable and good. In a humanist perspective, we simply say it's our birthright of being human that we are inherently worthy. When we come to the word dignity, it gets a little more complicated. There are many ways to interpret dignity. Dignity plays out in our world in a variety of ways. In fact, the concept of dignity didn't really even come into play until the Enlightenment period of the 17th and 18th centuries with Immanuel Kant's work, where he proclaimed that reason, the human's ability to reason and make moral decisions, created the stage for us to be dignified. I think a lot of us are used to dignity or dignified being a part of status or rank. When we behave in a dignified manner, we act with composure, calmness, self-possession. I think you all have some sense of what it means to operate in a dignified manner. In our spiritual deepening circles this month, we're considering worth and dignity. And in our first week's exercise, we're looking at faces and reflecting on what worth and dignity mean as interpreted through these various faces. And one of the things that my circle concluded in this process is that worth and dignity go hand in hand. You can't have dignity if you don't have a strong sense of your own self-worth. We can all think of examples of dignitaries where it's very clear to see through quickly that they don't have that self-worth. So you have to feel good about yourself as a person in order to have dignity. And that's how worth and dignity work for an individual. I have some examples to share with you. We're going to try this new, there we go. So there's an example of dignity by status. Now look in her eyes. Does the word steely come to you? Those of you who know her story, know the history of her life, know that when she was young, dignity might have been a robe or a crown that she put on. But by the way she lived her life and the things that she had to deal with in her life, that dignity was built in her sense of worth, her sense of value. She claimed that dignity of the crown. Whether you agree with royalty or not, you have to acknowledge that her life has brought her to own the dignity that she wears. Aww. I miss him so much. Look at that face. Look at that face. That's the man who took crap for 8 years, and he stood tall. A lesson for us, a role model for us in so many ways. Look, is that a dignified face? What makes that face so dignified? The eyes, the clearness, the mouth, the way the mouth is held, relaxed and yet resolute. That's dignity that comes from without and from within. So let's turn to a couple of faces we won't recognize, but are useful for us to consider. I don't know this man. I don't know his name. I see a countryside behind him, and I'm choosing to imagine him as a person from a war-torn country, possibly someone who's a refugee. For people whose lives have been torn apart, people who have been put down and rejected, dignity is a hard-fought thing. And you can see almost a little bit of anger in his eyes. Almost a little bit of, you know, I am who I am, despite what you think, despite the circumstances that I faced. A little bit of pride. Dignity, outward expression, comes from an inward source. And then our final picture is this fellow. Don't know him, don't know his name. It's been a hard life, wouldn't you say? Do you see the dignity in his eyes? I am worthy. Maybe a person who was homeless in some parts of his life. Being homeless is one of the greatest indignities you can experience. When they clear the homeless camps, they take away everyone's possessions. They're gone. You don't get them back. The things that you cling to, that represent you, that you value, they're gone. Your dignity is stripped away. And yet, there's that dignity in his eyes, a dignity that comes from within despite the challenges that he's had in his life. So there's two other, I wanted to take him off our screen so we're not distracted by him. Thank you. There's two other words to this principle, affirm and promote. When I think of this idea of affirming the worth and dignity of every person, what really comes clearly to my mind is the healthcare environment. Anyone who's been in the hospital or visited anyone in the hospital, and they train us in chaplaincy to do this. You are the most vulnerable that you can be when you're in the hospital. Just think of those hospital gowns. My God. It's like they're designed to make it hard on you. They're designed to make it easy if something happens to you and they need to quickly give you treatment. But if you think about the healthcare environment, doctors and nurses and orderlies and aides are all trained to let people have their dignity, to support their dignity. I can imagine a scene of somebody walking down the hall with their walker or struggling to walk down the hall with their hospital gown, and the aide is gathering the gown behind to make sure that the person's body is covered. The person might not even have any awareness, but that aide is preserving their dignity. They're affirming their dignity by an act of kindness. When I think of the idea of affirming someone's worth and dignity, of course I think of the opposite. And the opposite of affirming is othering. The opposite of affirming is saying, you're not like me, you're not in my tribe. I'm not going to affirm you. In fact, I'm going to find ways to say and think negative things about you so that I can solidify my tribe and solidify my own importance. Slavery, of course, is the perfect example of that. Prostitution. People who hire prostitutes are perpetuating people whose worth and dignity has been stripped away from them. I often think in this context of worth and dignity of people who are transgendered. People who are born with a certain biological sex, but know in their own hearts that they identify with the gender that is different from their biological sex. I think of the challenge of transgendered people when they're transitioning and they're trying to identify with that new gender, going out representing in the new gender for them, in the gender that their heart feels but their body is not. The challenge of finding dignity, the challenge of living with dignity when people are choosing to say, I don't understand, this is bad, this is wrong. Affirming the worth and dignity of each person. It's really kind of basic in a way, which makes it hard. Treating people kindly and respectfully. That store clerk who got your order wrong. That obnoxious coworker who constantly wants to tell you stories about their dog. This is the day-to-day challenge of this principle. So the word I haven't talked about yet is promoting. The principle is to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Promoting, speaking up on behalf of others, speaking out when you see someone treated unfairly. And promoting worth and dignity includes yourself. Not that you're going to take out a billboard to say, you know, Reverend Lucy is great. But I'm going to do that, not you. Nobody take out billboards. But you're not going to promote yourself with a bullhorn on the street corner, but you're going to promote yourself in your life. Self-respect, owning your dignity, treating yourself with dignity. That's the aspect of affirming and promoting worth and dignity of every person, including yourself. So many people tell me that they like a takeaway from the sermon. And so I have homework assignments for you. The first one comes out of what I just said about promoting yourself. I encourage you to take your own inherent worth and dignity seriously. And that could be as simple as looking in the mirror and saying, "Good morning, you're doing a great job." Just connecting with yourself, affirming yourself. That could be a daily practice. And I've said so many times, you're probably sick of hearing this, if I had a magic wand, I would make everyone feel worthy. And so much of the pain and struggle in this world would go away. So let yourself feel worthy. Support yourself. Promote yourself and your own worthiness. The second thing I'm asking you to do is something that is in your order of service. If you could pull out, there's a flyer in there. It's a white piece of paper. One of the challenges of transgendered people is using a restroom in public. And our world is not making it easy. You know these stories of states that say you have to use the bathroom of your birth gender even though you totally present in every way as male. So California has passed a law last year that says that if a business has single stall bathrooms, so that means a bathroom that you walk in and there's the toilet and the sink right there, there's no stalls in there, just a single bathroom, they have to be non-gendered. They have to be gender neutral. So if you have a favorite restaurant that you go to and you notice that there's a women's room and a men's room and they're both just single stall bathrooms, I encourage you to take that flyer and show it to the manager of the business and say, "I want to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of transgendered people or genderqueer people, and I'm asking you to uphold this law by making sure that your bathrooms are signified as gender neutral." It just simply means they have to change the signs. That's all that it means. Our bathrooms over there by the Foz room are gender neutral bathrooms. They used to be the male and the female. And many years ago, before my time, we changed them to anybody can use any of them. Promote the worth and dignity of every individual. This is a powerful thing that you can do. Especially as cisgendered people, cisgendered meaning you have the gender you were born with and that's the gender that you identify with and present with. So I encourage you to read that flyer and think about the places where you do business and challenge them, encourage them to change their bathrooms, and you will make the life of a transgendered person so much better. You will be promoting through your actions their inherent worth and dignity. So the final task that I have for you is one that I've challenged you with before, and that's what I call the ministry of the greeting. That means when you see somebody on the street, you say hello to them. You say, "Hello," you don't have to say this, but in your heart you're saying, "Hello, human being, I see you." And if you want to do the advanced version, you can always wave to them. Thank you, Beth. You can wave. I do this on my bike rides and my walks, and it lifts my spirits and allows me to connect with all the wonderful, inherently worthy humans in my sphere. But actually, it's even simpler than that. Namaste. The inherent worth and dignity in me sees the inherent worth and dignity in you. Namaste. So may it be.